All rise.
Welcome to the Cyber Law and Business Report. Get the top story on the hot-button internet legal topics of the day. It's your home for the latest on internet law and policy. Hear the latest net trends impacting business and have your questions answered right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report. Now, please welcome your host, the founder of the Internet Law Center, Bennett Kelly.
Good morning. This is Bennett Kelly. You're listening to Cyber Law and Business Report. Please be seated. We're broadcasting live from the Internet Law Center here in Santa Monica. LA area is bracing for another visit by President Obama. Who knows, maybe he'll stop by the studio. Not likely. But in any event, we still have a good show for you today. And we have Carl Kronberg returns with yet another victory story on the spam front. And then we're going to have news updates in the second half hour. And today is actually the anniversary, I believe it, do my math correctly, the 40th anniversary of U.S. v. Nixon, where a unanimous Supreme Court said that President Nixon had to turn over the Watergate tapes, and that ultimately led to his demise and resignation as president. So, Carl, are you with us?
I'm with you. Thanks for inviting me, Bennett.
Thank you. We have Carl Kronberg, and Carl Kronenberger is the founding partner of Kronenberg Rosenfeld, one of the leading internet law firms in the space, and he has been very active in spam litigation, and he's been on our show multiple times, and he actually just recently won a victory in a class action case. And an important case because it had quite an extensive discussion on the issue of what constitutes a subject line that violates California's email statute. And so, Carl, why don't you tell us a little about this case?
Sure. Well, why don't we start off with the fact that the class action lawsuit, and that's
we haven't seen that many of them so far, surprisingly.
You haven't, and it's a little concerning because, you know, somebody gets one or two emails and then they're making allegations on behalf of a class and demanding $1,000 for thousands or tens of thousands of emails the entire class of people these recipients received. So it's the damages are sort of mind-boggling, and they're all statutory. So it's a concern, and I personally think that you're going to see more of these. You know, there is one in Los Angeles that I think that they filed a motion for preliminary approval of a settlement on a class action basis. So once the judge sort of approves or denies that, that'll be an interesting reference point for everybody who follows this area of the law.
I mean, if you think about it, Carl, the statute, well, the amended statute is, what, about 80 or 9 years old now, and it's just surprising that it's taken this long.
That's right. I think it's the big reason why I don't think you see a lot of class actions is that I just don't think that the statute was designed for plaintiffs to bring claims on a class basis. You've got these huge statutory damages of $1,000 per email, and, you know, with emails, some people are getting, 100, 500 emails a day from all different types of friends and businesses and marketers. And so the damages in most class action claims are many times the worth of the defendants. So it doesn't really make sense. I don't think that the statute was designed for it. So it is a little bit of a disturbing trend that all of a sudden you've got these class action complaints popping up.
And so, in this case, tell us a little bit about the plaintiff. He's not one of our usual suspects.
That's right. The case is Nicholas Bontrager versus Showmark Media. I represented Showmark Media. Mr. Bontrager is an attorney, and he was also represented by counsel in this case. But I think it's interesting to note that an attorney is the one suing here. The attorney received an email, and the email had the subject line, lawyer, media, comma, top lawyers in California. So that was the subject line, and Mr. Bontrager brought a class action lawsuit alleging that subject line was misleading and that he wanted $1,000 for that email, statutory damages, and he wanted $1,000 for every other person in California, actually mostly attorneys who received these emails. He wanted $1,000 for every email that was sent to an attorney in California. So we're talking millions of dollars in damages in this complaint.
And coincidentally, I just got that email this week.
Oh, really? Okay, you would have been in the class. You would have been...
Damn you, Carl!
So, let's talk about what the email is about. Because it was about a plaque that you could buy that reflected how you are a top lawyer in California. And it said it was $159 with shipping and handling. And that was the offer. So, but Mr. Bontrager, after reading both the subject line and the content of the email, thought that, or I guess was, misled. That's what he told the court. He was misled by this. So the court, we filed a motion to dismiss, which is something very early in the case. And there's a high burden on a motion to dismiss because you assume the facts as alleged by the plaintiff are true.
Right, and so then also, and you were moved to the federal court, and in federal court, the general standard is what is called notice pleading. As long as the claim is, it is enough to put the other side on notice of what the claim is, it should proceed.
That's right. So we got this in the federal court, and we filed a motion to dismiss this claim, and our argument was that this didn't violate the California spam statute because it wasn't misleading to reasonable people. I mean, the statute says that there's a violation if the subject line is likely to mislead a recipient about a material fact regarding the contents or the subject matter of the message. And the judge agreed with us, and the judge dismissed this claim, the spam claim, with prejudice, so they couldn't bring it again. They couldn't amend their complaint. And and it's interesting because the judge really went into the law, and this is a long opinion. This is a an 18-page opinion about subject lines.
Right. That is extensive.
Yeah. So the judge went through a lot of the case law and really went into the mechanics of the statute and how you do an analysis of whether or not a subject line violates the statute. And to try to give it to you in a nutshell, it's really not about whether or not the subject line is truthful or if it's false. It's about whether or not someone would be misled if they read that subject line about what's in the email itself. So let's look at this email. It said in the subject line, it didn't say there's anything free. It didn't say that there was going to be a free plaque or anything like that. It just said lawyer media, top lawyers. And of course, Mr. Bontrager was not alleging that he was not a top lawyer. That would have been an interesting argument if he would have said, "Well, I'm a horrible lawyer, and therefore I was misled because." It said, use the term top lawyer. When you compare the subject line to the content of the email, it's consistent. It matches up. And for that reason, the judge said there was no violation of the statute. Now, Bennett, you've seen a lot of these cases, and you've also seen probably a lot of bad subject lines. I mean, the ones that just jump out at you is when it says something's free,
right?
Not when there's an implication that it's free, but it's not free.
But I've also seen, and I think somewhat of the, I think some of the plaintiffs bar has definitely, done a fair amount of legal yoga in terms of the degree to which they've stretched this argument. You know, I think recall one plaintiff, I believe, said that it was an offer for a loan, and that was deceptive and confusing because it led him to believe that he owned a house, and he didn't. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the counsel quipped then, well, imagine what would happen if he received an ad about a women's products. But I do think there has been a need for some kind of case law and clarity here, just because of the kind of the divorce from reality standard that it seems the plaintiff's bar was really trying to set forth as what you know could be arguably a deceptive subject line. And do you think this ruling will rein that in at all?
I really hope it will. I mean, we see so many of these sort of shakedown operations where you know people think that they can just print their emails out, file a complaint in court and get some money. And hopefully this raises the bar when it comes to subject lines. I thought it was fairly clear. The subject lines and fairly benign. What I see out there a lot is where you have a subject line that says something like, how are you? Or what's up? You know, when there's an implication of a friendship, like
right.
Someone you know, of a personal acquaintance, or something like, you know, we just deposited money into your bank account. Click to find out more. Things that are just flat out wrong and false. So this seemed to be so benign, and I must say that you're seeing more and more of these arguments about benign subject lines violating the statute, especially when you've got all the Trankos arguments, and plaintiffs can say, well, we have three different arguments on why this violates the statute. One, the subject line is misleading, and two, there's this from line that's generic, and three, the who is record is protected. So you're seeing more and more of that, and hopefully these decisions are helping. We've got the Braun-Trager decision. Last time I was on the show, we discussed the DeWitt case, which I think laid out the law for us, and it set some better standards when it comes to from names and how it affects the Trankos analysis. So I definitely hope that we're raising the bar here and making it harder for plaintiffs' attorneys to bring these suits with this decision like in the Braun-Trager case.
Now, do you think that they're going to, because in the past when they've haven't succeeded, they've thought about going to the legislature to try to make it easier. And, the California legislature has been fairly friendly to the plaintiffs' bar. Do you think it's bad enough that they might actually feel they have to get rescued from Sacramento?
Possibly, but I have to ask the question, how much worse could it get? I think it's a pretty bad statute myself. $1,000 is a ridiculous amount
right.
of money in statutory damages. It's a one-sided attorney's fees provision. You've got sort of this strict liability that's laid out in the statute, and that's supported by various case law out there. I think there are major problems with the statute, and I don't know how it could get much worse. Now, of course, I shouldn't underestimate the creativity of plaintiffs' lawyers.
Right.
Up there.
I forget the version. I mean, there was a version that Balsam working with state senator or assemblyman, then Leno, that was. Went to the governor's desk but was vetoed in, I think, 2008.
We should go back and look at that. There's also a possibility that some of the arguments that they made were actually contained and affirmed in case law, like the ValueClick case, where it sort of laid out sort of strict liability. Because that's one of the best things that the plaintiffs have going for them with this statute is that you do have this strict liability for advertisers, even if they never saw and really had no input into sort of the crafting and the sending of these emails. So there's a possibility that it could have been, but that may be an interesting thing to take a look at, and I think I'll do that. Next time on the show, we'll talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to pull up my good friend's website and to see what it is that he said about the bill. And mm-hmm. although alternatively, he said that he wrote it and didn't write it. So his website says, "This is why I co-wrote a stronger anti-spam law for California Assembly member Jared Hoffman," but in a brief, I believe he said that he did not write it. So it's interesting how his memory sometimes changes. But what were the key things that he had? He has a one pager, and the key provisions, I believe, it would provide examples of falsity and deception, add standing for district attorneys and city attorneys, and that was for the one plaintiff who was the city attorney for Los Angeles, I believe.
Yes.
Allows courts to order injunctions, and what were the other key provisions, though? I think it was to lower the bar for him to have standing or something. There was something that would basically, he lost a few cases, and so when he lost, he therefore concluded that it was a loophole. He said, "We have to close these loopholes." And so we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about a little bit about that statute and talk about some of the Carl's work in this area after these messages. You're listening to Cyber Law Business Report only on Webmaster Radio and iHeartRadio.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
While some affiliate networks can give you offers, Affiliate Offers Network gives you offers that pay big. Why do affiliates work with Affiliate Offers Network? How about because they work with powerhouse CPAs like Affiliate.com? How about that affiliates get paid every Monday to kick off their work week? Plus, learn how their Green Bucket system can turn your email, display ad, social, video, or mobile impression into profitable income. Get connected today with Affiliate Offers Network. Call 312-560-0175 or visit AffiliateOffersNetwork.com.
Oh, yeah. My day is done. Time for happy hour.
You're already done for the day?
Yeah, because I use CertifiedKnowledge.org. Their PPC tools literally save me hours every day.
How do you keep on top of all of Google's new features?
Easy. With Certified Knowledge, their interactive learning modules keep me up to date. And if there's something I don't know, I can watch their video lessons without having to hunt around the Google help files.
Great. I'm ready to expand my knowledge.
Hi, I'm Brett Geddes. I'm the only leader officially supported by Google to teach the advanced track of the AdWords Seminars for Success. I personally recommend CertifiedKnowledge.org as your one-stop shop for all your PPC needs.
Learn, optimize, connect. Be smart. Go to CertifiedKnowledge.org now.
Johnson, what's this mantis I keep hearing about? Do we need to call an exterminator?
No, sir. Moby Mantis is our new SMS marketing tool.
SM what?
SMS, text messaging. Moby Mantis lets us communicate directly with our customers in real time. We can send promos, coupons. It even lets our customers market for us by sharing offers with their friends online. It's been great for business.
Sounds expensive.
Actually, I sign us up for an extended free trial. It hasn't cost us a dime.
Good work, Johnson. I guess the only thing we'll be exterminating is the competition.
To get your free extended trial of Moby Mantis, text RADIO to 21691. That's RADIO to 21691 for Moby Mantis.
BubbleFast burst onto the e-commerce scene as a family-owned shipping supply provider back in 1999. The product line has grown, but Mark and Robin still own and operate BubbleFast as a family business. Being sellers themselves has taught them what online sellers need to safely and affordably deliver their products to their customers. BubbleFast is proud to be an active member of the community of online sellers. Mark and Robin sponsor seller meetup groups, share shipping tips and tricks through social media, and always love talking to customers and helping solve shipping challenges. Check out the website at BubbleFast.com. Sign up for the Bubble Briefs newsletter to join the Bubble Fast family. Use promo code WMR to get a 5% discount. Or call Mark and Robin at 877-599-7447. Happy shipping from Mark and Robin at Bubble Fast.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on WebmasterRadio.fm.
And we're back. This is Bennett Kelly broadcasting live from the Internet Law Center. And I have Carl Cronenberger back and with Cronenberger Rosenfeld in San Francisco. And Carl, we have the president today. You don't, but you have a victory we're talking about, and I think that's a fair trade. So you won not just on the spam count, but there was also a count that dealt with basically two other statutes. Why don't you fill us in on that?
Yeah, this is what I sometimes call one of those kitchen sink complaints where everything's thrown in that they could possibly claim. So they, in addition to claiming that this it's one email that said lawyer media top lawyers in California, in addition to that email violating the spam statute, they said it violated the unfair competition law statute, and it also violated the false advertising statute in California. So I thought that was interesting to see how the judge dealt with that. I think first there are no money damages here, and we argued there needed to be some sort of damages in order to have claims under these statutes. And most importantly, the UCL, unfair competition law statute, they're not. It's really restitution and not damages, and you can't get restitution here because he didn't buy anything.
Right.
There's nothing that could be the basis for restitution, the plaintiff argued that he wanted injunctive relief. That was also a remedy. So even though that there's no actual damages, he still wants injunctive relief. But the judge said you need to be injured in some way in order to get injunctive relief. There has to be some loss of money or loss of property to get injunctive relief. Now, he made the argument. He said that it wasted his time, that it took up excessive bandwidth that he was using to actually download this one email.
Right.
And the judge just was not buying it. And spent a good amount of time laying out the case law in this area, because usually you don't see these sort of claims in spam complaints. Usually there are these rifle shot claims that just involve the spam statute. So the judge spent a good amount of time laying out the law and said, there's no injury in fact. There's no loss of money, no loss of property, and there's no way that there could have been any restitution. So both the unfair competition law claim and the false advertising claim were dismissed.
So Do you have a sense, and maybe I should ask this question 6 months from now, after these rulings have really had their impact, but what is the state of the plaintiff's bar in the spam area today? Are cases, are the number of cases changing at all? Are the dollar value, are their strategies different? Are they using Superior Court more than, small claims, or are they doing class actions now when before they hadn't? What is the state, and how has it changed?
Well, I think they're getting smarter, and they've got a good amount of experience now. Dan Balsam is a even though he's a fairly young attorney in terms of being out of school just a few years, he's a smart guy, and he's got a good amount of experience now, and I feel like he's upped his game, because he's not really bringing claims on his own behalf anymore. It's really on behalf of a bunch of clients, and he's filing a lot of cases these days, and they're for larger amounts of money, significantly larger. Gone are the days when Dan Balsam is asking for $1,000.
Right.
He's asking for sometimes six and sometimes seven figures in a lot of these cases. And you have some new players. There's this Jacob Harker, an attorney in San Francisco, that's teaming up with Mr. Balsam, and Timothy Walton, who's also a very experienced litigator of these spam claims, to be on the plaintiff side. And then another twist here is that you have some players in Southern California You've got this Jeffrey Pollack, who is an experienced business litigator who's getting into spam litigation. And then when it comes to class actions, you have the Cavitech firm, very respected class action firm. In fact, I think Mr. Cavitech is head of the plaintiff's attorneys organization in California. They're getting into it with their filing, and Balsam was co-counsel on that. So I feel like they've upped their game, and they're filing a lot more. I feel like there are a good number of settlements out there. At the same time, you're slowly getting some of these new decisions out, like the Bontrager case, the DeWitt case. I think the one thing that could really change things is if a federal court comes in and analyzes the strict liability component of this statute, because I think that there's a very good argument that to the extent that you interpret the state statute to have strict liability, that interpretation is preempted by the federal statute. And you really need a federal judge to make this big decision. And I think that could happen. And if that does, that would really shake up things on the plaintiff's
because the strict liability is so basically, you know, for those listening, the California spam law initially was passed in 2003 to ban all unsolicited email and even then some, because it was defined so poorly. Congress, 82 days later, Congress passes the Can Spam Act that includes an exception that allows states to regulate email to the extent that it deals with falsity, deception, and email. California then amends its statutes to fall within that exception, you know, theoretically. And so your point would be that somehow that by creating strict liability on the advertiser, that they've gone beyond regulating falsity and deception, because that would be the liability of the marketer, presumably, and that by extending it to the advertiser, they're doing something more than that. Is that the argument?
That's right, that there's some intent component in the federal statute, and to the extent that the state statute sort of finds liability without that sort of intent, then that would be preempted. And you know, I think some of these Trankos arguments are subject to compelling arguments that they're preempted, because a lot of these, you know, just by hiding with privacy protection someone's contact information, does that really rise to the level of something that's false and deceptive?
Yeah, because it could still be true, and so yeah, that would not fall within that, I would think. Although I know the FTC, when the statute was passed and right after, you know, the FTC said the whole purpose of having, you know, of clear from line is just so they knew who to look up to sue, and so if you don't know who's the email is coming from, you know, you don't know whether to open it, and then once you open it, you don't know who to contact. Although if it's CAN spam compliant, there should be some address.
That's right, and I think there's also some language in the Gordon versus Virtuemundo case, Ninth Circuit case, that would support a strong argument that hiding contact information, you know, behind who has protection services, cannot serve as the basis of any sort of liability under the state statute.
Now there was a criminal
arguments would be preempted.
There was a criminal case, Cyberheat, I recall, and where the party had gone to such great lengths to hide who they were, you know, by registering a domain through like so many different entities, you know, in multiple continents, that the court found that was somehow deceptive, even though it probably was correct. But they did so in a way that it was just so involved to get there, they felt that was deceptive.
Well, the Trankos case as well. I mean, in that case, Trankos went to these great lengths to hide their identity.
And then they had the quote, too, that hurt them. where their CEO said, I just want to make sure Dan Balsam can't find out my address.
That's right. But the problem is under Gordon versus Virchimundo, just obscuring truthful information, it arguably cannot be the basis of liability under a state statute, because that does not rise to the level of the falsity or deception, which is a carve out for preemption in canned spam.
So, do you think this area will dry up anytime soon, or it's hard to tell? Because the plaintiffs bar doesn't respect federal court. They say, well, it's only advisory in state court.
Well, except when you're dealing with preemption issues, what the federal court says is going to trump anything that the state court says. I can see their point. I think what you really need to look at is the level of analysis in a lot of these cases. Like, for example, the Braun-Trager case is a very well-written decision. Compare it to the ValueClick case a few years ago by the state court, which I thought was a horribly written decision. I don't think it was very well thought out. I just think the level of writing and legal analysis with these spam cases is so much higher in federal courts. Now, of course, you do have some state court judges that do the thorough analysis and have well-written opinions, but for the most part, I'm not impressed by a lot of the decisions in state court, and that's why I think a lot of defendants sort of gravitate to federal court, especially because it's easier to make the preemption argument.
Now, are the courts up in your area in San Francisco County and Santa Clara County, are they backed up? I mean, because right now, if I filed a slap motion, which is supposed to be heard on an expedited basis, if I filed that now in Santa Monica court or an L.A. County court, I would get a 2015 date. I wouldn't get one for this year. And that's for an expedited motion.
It's not as backed up up here. I mean, still, you're looking sometimes at 3 months out, but especially in Marin, to try to get a hearing date.
Really, Marin is worse.
Yeah, I don't know why it has been. I know that there have been a number of cases filed in Alameda recently.
Yes.
To report there, because I think that's Balsam's hub of operations now, and there's another.
Oh, he's moved.
I believe so. I don't want to reveal any personal information about where Dan Balsam lives at all. Respect him as an attorney, and I don't want people going after him, harassing him.
That makes
fun
of us. But the thing about Marin's interesting. Actually, the courthouse is interesting because that's the Frank Lloyd Wright courthouse.
That's right. It's a great courthouse, just in terms of the architecture, sort of built into the hill there. And then you have sort of the Superior Court in Alameda County, which as I said is where you see some complaints filed by Balsam, but also Mr. DeWitt, because he lives, I think, in the Berkeley.
He's in Berkeley.
Area.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you're seeing a number of decisions out of that court as well.
Yeah, and actually, we mentioned earlier, I won a demur against DeWitt recently, and he's appealing that now. So,
what's the status of that? Have you started briefing it?
We're about to start briefing. I think we're waiting for the briefing schedule, and but he, I think his. He's going to appeal because he wasn't granted leave to amend. And I think that's probably going to be the key issue for him. Although, he also may challenge, I'm assuming he'll challenge the substantive decision on the motion to dismiss. But it really was just a Mickey Mouse complaint. And it just didn't detail anything. Lumped together two plaintiffs, didn't specify who was responsible for either party, and I honestly think my client was mainly there as a way to defeat removal, And it really did seem like it was fraudulent joinder. But we'll see. And, you know, hopefully maybe we'll get a well-written decision on that, and we'll be able to add to the growing, panoply of opinions that are really trying to define this better and in a more rational way.
Well, he's also filed an appeal in the case that I recently had with him, where my client was Simply Inc., and that was the case we discussed last time I was on, and that was about generic from names.
Right.
So that notice of appeal has been filed. So that looks like that's going to be. I don't think we've got a briefing schedule yet, but that's being teed up right now too.
Is Washington as active as it used to be, or has that died with Mr. Gordon's demise?
You know, you don't really hear about it. It wouldn't surprise me if there's some sort of low-level spam activity there where there's sort of smaller demands. You just don't see the cases, the written decisions coming out of Washington anymore. California, it's such a great statute that a lot of plaintiffs in other states are actually using it. You know, I've dealt with plaintiffs in, for example, Georgia, using it in Georgia court.
They use the California statute in Georgia court.
That's right, for California sender.
Wow. You
know. So you've seen it in other state courts as well. I think the smarter plaintiffs would try to find a connection to California, because you've got the statutory damages, you've got the strict liability, and the benefits of a lot of case law, a lot of it is friendly to plaintiffs.
Is there any? And I know that the argument has been made in the example case law that you have no duty to mitigate a crime, and that technically, I think this violation is this a misdemeanor, or is it? I'm trying to remember whether the statute is a misdemeanor as well, but
I don't think so.
Is there any duty to, anything on, can plaintiffs actively, can they run into the street so the ambulance hits them, so to speak, in this context? Or have they been doing that?
Now, this is a big issue, I believe, because there is an argument to be made that much of the, quote, harm, and I say, I put that in quotes because I don't think there's any real harm, but most of the harm that's being suffered by plaintiffs often that harm is occurring because they either signed up for the email or didn't sign up for it, but when they got it, they kept clicking again and again and again on it, and pretty much every single mail system that's being used today will send you additional emails if you express any sort of interest. And the plaintiffs all know that. So they wait until they receive sometimes hundreds of emails that they received because of their own action. And then they sue on those. And I think that's highly questionable activity. I mean, I think it violates the various principles that are recognized in pretty much every state, common law principles about how you cannot create the harm and then make a claim for relief based on that.
Well, and they also, not that they have, we talked, they may not have a duty to mitigate, but they have also removed other people's efforts at mitigation. So, for example, I believe that at least one of them pays their ISP extra not to filter their email stream so that their email stream includes as much spam as possible. And using that point, that would seem to be, something that, but for that effort, they wouldn't get some of these emails. So why should they be, basically they're buying liability. Why should the court enforce that?
You definitely see that with a lot of the old, say, spam litigation mills. And I use that term because sometimes courts even used it for companies like ASUS Internet Services, which we've talked about before on the show. They had an elaborate operation where they were gathering emails. They shut off filtering, spam filtering, for the entire ISP, and the ISP existed pretty much for the purpose of filing spam suits. And they were getting all these emails from legacy emails from old customers that were no longer customers, and then the ISP was making claims on their behalf. And you don't see that as much anymore. I think what you may be seeing is plaintiffs using more sophisticated means to analyze email, because they're dealing with a lot more than they used to. When if it was just 10 emails, it was not a big deal. But if you've got 3,000 or 4,000 emails, there may be a point where they're building their own tools to analyze header information, and in order to identify and count emails for various defendants.
Well, we're running short, so Carl, if people want to find out more information about what you're up to and your firm, what's the best way for them to do so?
Well, they would go to my website at krinternetlaw.com, krinternetlaw.com, and we've got summaries of all of our recent victories in the area of spam litigation, as well as information about our entire practice. Actually, a new website we just launched last week.
So I looked at it. It's very nice. I liked it.
Yeah.
And what's the square you guys are off of?
Union Square.
Yeah, right off Union. It's a great office, great location, nice office. And definitely look up Carl if you're in San Francisco. And I want to thank you for joining us again, and congratulations. Let's hope this decision has a major impact.
Yeah, well, thank you, Bennett. Again, I appreciate you inviting me.
Well, all the best. So we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll do a news update, and we'll close out this edition of Cyber Law and Business Report after these messages.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
When you started your business, you first listened to your professors. Now that your business is growing and gaining ground, you only seek out professionals. PPC Professionals, an industry leader for highly optimized search marketing campaigns with over 30 years of combined management experience. Our professional approach to every campaign helps you find every avenue of revenue so that you can not only stay ahead of your competitors, but get a return on your investment and increase your bottom line. PPC Professionals, personal, professional, PPC services, ppcprofessionals.com.
Building better search engine rankings takes the right formula. Tracking those rankings is super simple.
All you need is AuthorityLabs.com.
Authority Labs uses automated daily rank tracking tools to monitor your site's performance or leverage their API to build your own tools. No matter what animal-labeled algorithms affect your ranking,
you should be using Authority Labs.
Unlimited users for no additional cost and white labeling can help keep your clients updated and save countless hours of creating reports. Whether you're running sites with just a few or millions of keywords,
what you need is AuthorityLabs.com.
Hey, this is Danny Sullivan to talk to you about Bruce Clay Incorporated. They've made Inc. Magazine's list of growing private businesses and have exhibited and sponsored at my conferences since the very beginning. You've seen their search engine relationship chart, or you've read their SEO code of ethics, so you know they're SEO experts. But did you know they can help you with PPC, web analytics, web design, marketing strategy, promotion, and branding? Yep, get everything you need for success in the online marketplace. You can check it out from the professionals at Bruce Clay Incorporated. For over 10 years with offices worldwide, they've got the answers you need. Check them out today at BruceClay.com.
InternetMarketingNinjas.com is the online dojo of the highly trained and skilled Internet Marketing Ninjas. Disavow documents, reconsideration requests, Panda and Penguin penalties. Let our superior SEO ninjas confront all of your link-related issues. The Internet Marketing Ninjas are equipped to master any marketing exercise, content creation, authorship, link building, PPC, and more. Plus, build more buzz for your brand with our social media marketing strategy. Discover all that the Internet Marketing Ninjas can do for you. Visit the online dojo now at InternetMarketingNinjas.com.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on webmasterradio.fm.
And we're back, and I want to thank Carl again. He's a great guy, and we actually refer cases to each other, and so he's someone I think very highly of in this field. Couple of news updates. First of all, I want to send a congratulations to my alma mater, Georgetown Law School, which has launched a new center on privacy and technology. And one of the professors is Professor David Vladek, who had been the director of Bureau of Consumer Protection at the FTC for a number of years. And so definitely look for Georgetown to assert itself in this space. And they're right across the street from the FTC Conference Center down by the Capitol. So look for them to be playing a major role. Some news coming out of Washington. There's a new head of the criminal division at the Department of Justice, replacing my friend Lenny Brewer, is Leslie Caldwell. And she stated right off from the bat that she is going to be making cybercrime a major priority. And so we're going to look to see what that leads to. And maybe we'll have someone from DOJ on the show. Interesting story coming out of Florida and the... I just keep it. Think of how Michael Dukakis used to say his name during the presidential campaign. The drug-running Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega, who's been released from prison in Florida but is now serving in time in prison in Panama, has sued Activision based on its Call of Duty Black Ops 2 game, claiming that there's a character there that appears to be based loosely on him and that it violates his right of publicity. And the EFF has been very critical of that and thinks that the case law in that area has gone too far, possibly. But we'll maybe have something more on that at a future show. Interesting. So say hello to my new friend. Is your Federal Express man, delivery person, a drug dealer? And, well, Department of Justice seems to think so. And they have indicted Federal Express for its role in delivering illegal online prescription drugs. And so there's a statement that from at least 2004 and beyond, no less than six different occasions, the DEA, the FDA, members of Congress, and their own staff informed FedEx that illegal internet pharmacy were using its shipper services to distribute controlled substances and prescription drugs in violation of the Controlled Substances Act and Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act. So clearly going after the point of distribution as a choke point in this area. The latest revelation from Edward Snowden kind of reminds me of the old Rodney Dangerfield joke. He would say, well, a guy asked me, got any naked pictures of your wife? And I said, no. And then he said to me, you want some? And apparently Edward Snowden says that it's commonplace for members of the NSA to pass around and intercepted naked photos. And so... I guess Rodney Dangerfield was quite present in that regard. The NSA, they have a response, and but we'll see. We'll have more on that later. Now, one thing I wanted to follow up on was last week's show. We talked a lot about the investigation of Ben Smith into Ripoff Report. And what you have there is a systematic campaign by Ripoff Report. And then, as I mentioned, also I have a case involving Vanessa Cacciadorian of Fresno, in which each one are trying to punish public participation in our process. They are trying to punish witnesses from testifying, punishing people from pursuing claims, and we have a concept in the law known as SLAP. Strategic litigation against public participation, where in the 70s and 80s, people would try to discourage companies from asserting, debating, making claims in public debate. For example, environmental groups would be threatened with litigation if they criticized some of the oil company practices or whatever. And it was concerned that the threat of litigation would actually lead to a silencing of critics. And so California and now many other states have passed what is known as Strategic Litigation Against Public Participation Act, and allows for a special motion. If someone sues you with the intent to silence you, you can file a motion, and the court will evaluate the case at a very early stage, and they decide whether it merits going forward, and thereby saving all the litigation costs that the threat were meant to involve. And the court is actually and then may award attorney's fees should the case found to be without merit. And so here we have almost like a reverse slap to prevent you or discourage you from continuing to express your viewpoint in the form of the judiciary. People like Ed Madison and Vanessa Cachedorian are punishing you extensively online and elsewhere solely for the purpose of making you not want to pursue your claim. And so should there be a reverse slap claim, should there be a statute that says if someone actively defames you with the sole intent to try to suppress your participation in a investigation, in a government forum, in a trial, should that be criminal, or should there at least be some civil remedies and some civil penalties to address that? And that's something I'm going to be fleshing out myself in the next couple of weeks. But I think it's worth discussion. Should there be a law now that the tool of online defamation has become so mechanized? Should there be a law to protect people so that this can't be used in that fashion? So we will be talking about that. But that's all we have for this week. I want to thank Carl once again for joining us. It's been a pleasure having him.
Can I also thank you, Bennett?
This is sure. Anytime, Brasco. What
because,
for?
Well, because as far as I've learned, you mentioned in your little promo for today's program, you were named one of the most influential e-commerce lawyers by the LA Business Journal.
Yes, and in fact, they cited this show as one of the reasons for naming me. So,
really?
Yes. The work that we've done here, particularly in the work in the highlighting, in the write-up, it mentions the work we've done in highlighting the victims of cyber harassment and revenge porn. So,
that's great.
Well, thank you. And so I appreciate the shout out. This is an important forum. We're here to not only talk about what's going on in the law, but see if we can shape it. So we invite our listeners to express themselves as well. So please, let's keep this dialogue going. It's been fun. We're going to keep doing what we've been doing. So thank you very much, Brasco, we appreciate the recognition from the LA Business Journal.
Of course, and please allow me to go ahead and just mention, if you want to interact, we never mentioned enough about the Facebook page that we have available for all of you, but facebook.com/cyberlawradio. Make sure to go ahead and like the show, and we always add new updates up there when we can, especially when it comes up to upcoming programs. If you want to go and interact with us, please do so there. I wanted to make that point across.
And then in addition, the show has a Twitter account, Cyber Law Radio, and we also have a blog that has information on the show each week, cyberlawradio.wordpress. And of course, you can go to Webmaster Radio site and look at our archives as well. So, hopefully we have enough information there for you to, even if you're listening to past episodes, to kind of grasp, get the background information on the show. And, feel free, tell us what you think. It's an ongoing dialogue. This is radio. It's a discussion. And we value your part of it, too. So that's all we have here. Damn, the president just got here. Too late. But any event, have a great week. We'll talk to you next week. This is Bennett Kelly saying court is adjourned. Talk to you next week on Cyber Law and Business Report.
This has been a presentation of WebmasterRadio.fm, the world's largest business-to-business radio and podcast network. We welcome you to sample past episodes of this program, as well as our complete library of programs, on demand or on the air via our 24/7 live audio stream at www.webmasterradio.fm. The opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and hosts and do not necessarily reflect those of WebmasterRadio.fm's management or sponsors. Any rebroadcast or redistribution without authorized consent of WebmasterRadio.fm is prohibited.